Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host. Today, of course, is Thursday, October 5th, 2023, and we are now into the fourth quarter of 2023. And it's always a good time to reflect back on the year and see how things have gone and look forward to the results of the last quarter. And then, of course, we're entering next year into an election year, which always makes for fun watching of economic news during an election. Anyway, thank you for tuning into WVW TV. We appreciate your viewership, and of course, we also appreciate your kind support. As you know, WVW TV has been around a long time, I think 2006, and bringing you an alternative to the mainstream media that allows other viewpoints and important viewpoints to be added to the great marketplace of ideas. So we're very happy and thankful that you've chosen us to watch, and certainly I'm happy that you've chosen the Eastman Financial Report. And it's been an interesting run for the last better part of a year. The idea, of course, is to have a program that it brings you news and helps you to dissect what you're seeing in the news, applying critical thinking skills so that you are able to see past the headlines and have a better understanding of the American and global economy. So thank you so much for watching. As you know, we are not a pay-to-watch station. We're not a commercial station. We don't sell advertising, but we do have the kind support of viewers like yourself and also sponsors that sponsor our programming and keep us on the air. I'd like to personally thank my sponsor, Swiss America Trading, which, as I like to say, is a fine purveyor of precious metals, American company based in Arizona, and they've been in the precious metal space for a very long time, and they offer gold, silver, platinum, either bullion coins or bullion or even numismatic collection coins. And if you're interested in adding to your portfolio or perhaps investing in tangible precious metals, give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271. And they'll be happy to send you some free information on the space, on this sector. And you can read it and see for yourself whether that's right for you. If you're in the market for tangible precious metals, you can go to their website, SwissAmerica.com, and you can see what they have to offer. And of course, there's plenty of information. If you enter the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, you will be able to get free information from the website as well. And so if you're looking for a vendor of precious metals, please consider Swiss America. They've been a great friend of WVW TV, and we are certainly very happy to be working with them. So give them a call, 1-800-519-6271, or go to the website, use the promo code Eastman, and they'll be happy to send you some information. So I'd like to jump into the news today, and this is another one of these flattering days where just because you're watching a smaller news network and sort of an obscure financial report, don't think you're not getting the cutting-edge news, because you are. I've been talking this week about a couple of issues that are a cross between financial and political with respect to the federal budget. And I was delighted today, as I'm doing my show prep, we tend to look at the financial news and see what's all going on. And one of the major news outlets in the United States and globally has basically been parroting what I've been saying for the last 2 days. So, of course, I am flattered. You heard it here first, folks. If you tuned in on Monday, you beat the big boys by a couple of days. But there's an increasing interest in this story about what huge federal deficits are doing. And suddenly, as I've been saying for a week, these huge federal deficits take on a life of their own. They create inflation that affects, remember my three silos? You got the poor people, and you got the people in the middle, and then you got the rich, and the rich are doing just great right now. Interest rates are high, so they're earning lots of interest on their money. Inflation's chugging along, so all the property's going up in value. It's the people in the middle and on the other end that kind of are sort of left behind in this excitement. And part of the news that I was reading this morning is talking about how this fiscal policy is starting to create a global market reaction to American debt, federal debt, that is pushing the interest rates up higher than the Federal Reserve was thinking about when they adjusted their rates last month. And as a result of that, these huge deficits are having a fiscal impact on the country, and they're detethered from federal spending, even though they're caused by federal spending, and also monetary policy by the Fed. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting thing. And I'm glad that other people in the media are picking up on this phenomenon, because we tend to not wear tinfoil hats on this program. I try to be very moderated in my discussions. I mean, there's room for all sorts of theories. And, you know, it's a funny thing about conspiracy theories. Quite often, as a matter of fact, the majority of time, conspiracy theories tend to come true to some degree. And I like to bring the theories and put them on the table and let you sort through them. But it's fun to see major financial publications are sorting through the same theories that I'm discussing. So that's a good news. That's a bit of good news. There's also the story today about mortgage rates. If you remember yesterday, I was talking about 99% of Americans, according to some statisticians, can't afford to buy a house given the price of the house and the mortgage rates at 7.8%. And we're looking at a bump, you know, some experts are saying to 8%. And I had talked about all these bond pools, these mortgage pools, were assessing risk in the marketplace, risk of default. So they're asking for higher mortgage rates. And of course, that's outside of the control of the Federal Reserve, who's fiddling around here with the open market and the interbank rates, because that's how they adjust the interest rates. And what you're finding out is if you run the economy too far off the cliff, the Fed isn't going to be able to really help you out. Another interesting thing about the Fed, and this is sort of a segue, is that they are doing quantitative tightening, which is the opposite of quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is they go in and buy the federal bonds nobody else wants at the right interest rates so the federal government can keep borrowing money and spending it. Well, when they get this great big balance sheet at the Fed, there's this thought that perhaps as these bonds mature, you're not replacing them with new bonds. So the Fed balance sheet, the assets on the Fed balance sheet, which are all these federal bonds, that number is shrinking. And what it means is that the Feds are no longer holding. And when the bond matures, the Fed gets its money back, which is printed out of thin air. But the Fed has to, or the Federal Treasury has to go elsewhere to find buyers. And of course, that crowds out other borrowers and increases the rates in the marketplace. So that's another interesting problem. I'm happy to see that, you know, that the mainstream financial press is touching on that story as well. That's an interesting problem from the perspective of banks, because When the Federal Reserve in more normal times is tweaking the interest rates, it raises the rates. And we saw what happened back in March when I started this program, is that we had SVA Bank and then two other banks, and then there was a third, you know, fourth bank. And they went under because the Feds raised the interest rates. And banks are required to hold reserves. And they hold those reserves in the form of short-term bonds. And as interest rates, of course, went up, the market value of a bond is algebraically related to the interest rate level. So as rates go up, the principal of the bond goes down. The market value, mark to market, or the mathematical value goes down, and you have a shrink in your reserves, which puts your bank in a less stable position and can trigger a default. And that's what we saw when the Fed started raising the rates to kill off the 9% inflation that was reported last year. As the Feds are raising the rates very rapidly, historically, we're starting to see banks get wobbly, and four of them failed as a result of that. So now the interesting problem is, as the market, you know, remember my big global economy, this is all businesses and individuals who are in the business of the private sector, and this private sector is the economy. Then you get the government who taxes and spends to create social good. And then you got this monetary theory thing going on with the idea that you're somehow going to play games with the velocity of money, the quantity of money, and the price of money in an attempt to speed up or slow down this big private sector economy. And that's basically how the mechanism works. Well, when the market mechanisms take over and the Fed's ability to tweak the interest rates by a quarter point stops being relevant, then what ultimately happens is interest rates on debt goes up, because there's this cognizance within the marketplace that the risk profile has changed. And when risk changes, when risk goes up, interest rates go up as well. Because if you think about what an interest rate is, when you get into graduate school slicing and dicing here, there's a core interest rate, which is effectively return on capital. And then there's this inflation component, which means if inflation's moving along at 2%, part of your rate's going to be at 2%. And then there's going to be this risk component on top of that, the risk of default. And that's what creates the interest rate. If you were to dissect it and take graduate level classes on how to slice and dice interest rates. But at the end of the day, when the market perceives more risk, the Fed can set a benchmark, and they do. They tweak the number. But the risk portfolio or the risk profile takes over. And that becomes a real problem, because the Fed basically loses control of the market and the interest rates are going up higher than they had anticipated. And when that happens, and I mentioned this yesterday, it affects not only private borrowers, like companies that were highly leveraged, their business model was to borrow money at 2% and then make 6% on it and capture the 4% spread. Well, now as interest rates go up, those companies are finding themselves underwater and they're having to refinance at much higher rates, which means they have to raise their revenues quickly. And that of course, is inflation. Well, the same thing is happening with the Federal Reserve, with the federal government. As the federal government goes into the marketplace to sell bonds, to replace the bonds that just had to pay the Fed back, and the Fed, of course, cancels those Federal Reserve notes, it is pushing these interest rates higher. And of course, that has a real problem, because so many of the banks hold in their reserves these federal debt instruments, because they're safe. Obviously, the federal government's never going to default on its debt. So basically, if you're running a bank, the safest liquid asset you can buy is federal debt. And of course, as the market is driving the interest rates higher, it's also reducing the value, the mark-to-market value of your ratios. So the banks are finding themselves in a situation where their reserve value, and of course, since 2008, they have to mark to market, which means they got to calculate every night, what are these bonds worth based upon its interest rate? And it's an algebraic function. It's not speculative. You do the math, and this is what your bond's worth tonight. Well, those bonds are shrinking farther and faster than these money managers and bank managers had predicted when the Federal Reserve is fiddling around with the rates over here. So they're finding themselves in a deeper hole. Now, there was a credit facility created after 2008 for banks. And the idea, and it's created at the Federal Reserve, the idea was that if a bank runs into trouble, it can go to the Fed and it can borrow money for 1 year and at super cheap interest rates. And you put that into your reserves to make up that gap as your reserve bonds values are declining because rates are going up, whether the Fed's doing it or the market takes over and does it. Then what you're seeing is more and more banks going to this emergency window. And I believe the number was $108 billion. Now, given the fact that banks have like $22 trillion on deposit and $108 billion is pocket change, but the fact is they're going to that window. It's an emergency window, and they're still borrowing to true up. And every time the interest rates bump up, it's not because the Fed meets, for lunch every other month. It's the fact that the marketplace itself, and this is a global marketplace for interest rates, the market's saying, oh, we need more return because there's higher risk, okay? Federal government is $2 trillion a year in deficit. You got $33 trillion on the books. You got political chaos in Washington. We don't even know who the Speaker of the House is today. We're going to need a higher interest rate, because when the music stops, we're going to have a chair. You may not have a chair, but we're going to have a chair when the old musical chairs music stops. So that's what we're seeing in the marketplace. And it's having an effect on banks, because obviously, if you go and buy bonds for your reserve, because you're required to hold reserves, and of course, you can always go to the Fed window and all that, but what's happening is your assets overnight, they're shrinking, and people don't like to buy assets that go down in value. In an inflationary world, this is kind of counterintuitive, but in the banking world, you're exactly opposite of the market. When inflation goes up and interest rates go up, the value of your assets go down while everybody else's assets going up. Inflation, your house is going up in value. Well, if you're a bondholder and you're and interest rates go up, the value of your asset just went down until it matures, and then you get face value depending on how many years are left to maturity. So it becomes a really interesting problem for money managers. And I'll tell you, like I say, I never give investment advice. You are on your own. I have no ability to pick a stock or a bond or anything, but I can have a general observation of the bond market. And it is my opinion and my general observation that there are many mutual funds out there that hold bonds. And the idea is you get a great big blended mix of diversified mix of bonds, and the interest rates will all average out. And what a bond fund manager wants to do is you're always looking for these choice morsels of bond, you know, offerings that you can buy that are a little higher interest rate. And at the end of the year, you want to maximize your bond return on your bond portfolio. And that's the whole way that mutual funds work. And of course, they get a fee to do that. Well, if you're a bond fund manager and you're watching the Fed and the Fed's twiddling away here, every time they bump that up, all the bonds in your portfolio, they kind of go down. Well, when the market takes over, the market itself takes over and starts pricing interest rates higher, demands it higher. Well, then you've got this market risk and your bond portfolio value is declining when interest rates are going up. And when interest rates are coming down, of course, the value of your bonds are expanding. And they will trade perhaps even at a premium to capture additional value until such time as the bonds mature, then you get your $1,000 back. So effectively what I'm trying to say is I suspect that bond fund managers are not having a great week because as interest rates continue to nudge up, the bond value, the bond fund value goes down. Keep in mind that a mutual fund, your share, you buy shares in a mutual fund, they trade like sort of like stocks, okay? And at the end of the day, if you buy a bond fund share for $35 and interest rates go up, algebraically, unless there's some speculative reason, your $35 share is probably now worth $32 or $31 or $34 or something. It's lower. And that's what happens. So if you have your 401k money or your IRA money or your pension fund in a bond fund, the value of that fund will go down by some algebraic calculations. It won't go up. So, you know, higher interest rates, it's a transitional thing because obviously the bond fund managers are trying to sell off the lower valued bonds, and of course they want to get into the higher paying bonds. But that transition from your prior portfolio valuation to new is not without pain, and that's why bond funds don't tend to not do as well in times that inflation rises. Now there's always the bond fund manager that will be the exception to that rule. And, you know, it's like I say, you're on your own figuring that out. But the point of the matter is when interest rates continue to rise and they're pushed by market forces, banks, bond funds, others who have large blocks of bonds and can't afford to just own them and hold them. And then of course that affects your long-term yield. They're going to see a diminution of assets. If you're a regulated bank that's required to hold a certain ratio and you've got your assets and bonds, you know, you're losing money just by waking up in the morning. So anyway, that's an interesting phenomenon and push in the bond market based on these yields. I also wanted to talk about some of the other things that are happening in the news. And I saw a story yesterday that was really kind of troubling. I've always been a free market guy, believing in the American dream and in this American ideal that, you know, everybody can go out and be successful if you work hard and you play by the rules and you pay your bills and you save your money, that over time you will do well. I mean, you will be in the game, in the American game. You'll be a participant in the economy, and at the end, depending on your life you know, your life expectancy, you will come out on the back end, hopefully better off than when you started. And the news story today, and it's sort of troubling, is that 50% of Americans, and this is really something to think about, 50%, we got 330 million Americans, plus or minus, maybe you get 340, now everybody's sneaking in down south. Let's say it's 330 million Americans, we'll just use that number. And half of those, of course, that's like, that's a lot. That's almost like 200 million people. Half of them own 6% of the assets in the United States. And that was a real surprising number for me, that half of the people only own 6% of the assets. And that means everything from land to stocks and bonds to, you know, equipment to, you know, buildings, whatever. And what it tells you, and of course, to expand on that, the financial assets held by 50% are only 2.3%. And that is a very, very low number. I was trying to see when that the metric was decided, since 2009. Effectively, what it tells you in the United States today is, notwithstanding our $33 trillion in debt, the federal government racked up, and of course it's just, you know, throwing money at people. Half of Americans are really out of the game, and I think that becomes a really serious social problem for a country that's built on a, you know, that this democratic ideal of, you know, anybody can not only grow up to be president, but you can also, you know, be born, you can go to school, get an education, go out into the workplace or the marketplace, and you can create for yourself a modicum of individual wealth. And what this is telling is that the United States, as structured, is not generating that opportunity for half of the people who live here. And that's not a really good thing, because the other half, the people who have the other, 94% of all the assets, that becomes a world of the haves and the have-nots. And when you think about the social pressures involved in that, the have-nots, of course, are constantly driving governments to provide services to survive. And those that have, of course, are theoretically would be paying the taxes to support that. But we know that the taxes are totally delinked from federal spending because of the ability of the Federal Reserve to borrow $33 trillion in debt. And as a result, it puts the country in a very difficult position from an economic perspective. So from a policy perspective, again, this isn't a political show, but one would think that, back in the old days, I forget who ran a chicken in every pot, if that was Teddy Roosevelt, somebody promising everybody a chicken in every pot. That was back in the early 1900s. And what we're seeing today is a real bifurcation of American wealth. And it's probably a global phenomenon, because I think Americans are still better off than a lot of countries, a lot of people. But as wealth concentrates into this super class of billionaires and vast wealth of multi-centimillionaires, whatever, people worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and the concentration of wealth into a very select group of people suggests that, you know, democracy is perhaps not as stable as you think. And it's a cause for concern. I don't want to sound like I'm, some kind of a prairie progressive here, because I do believe in the free market, but the free markets need to be free. And that means, you know, access to, you know, the ability to enter a market, you know, barriers to entry should be low, and people should be able to not only get an education, get a job, and become, you know, successful to some, whichever level they choose, but also the ability to get into business and understand business. When you look at our policies, that's not the case. And the reason I lead into this is that there was a news story today that Americans are spending more on taxes than they do on food, healthcare, education, and clothing combined. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, Joe Biden's Labor Department, that's putting out this number. So on average, Americans are spending 25% on taxes. If you're in the top half, you're going to be paying closer to 38, 35, whatever, in taxes. But what it tells you is the tax burden to perpetuate the $33 trillion in debt and the $2 trillion a year deficit spending and the inability of the federal government, frankly, to function. I mean, what we're watching in Washington today is it's really creepy. I mean, you think about a president who, by any measure, is perhaps should be enjoying retirement. Okay, I'll be polite. You need to be young and sharp and, you know, with it. And it's difficult to see at the executive how that's functioning. Then you look at Congress and you think to yourself, you know, how many times in American history has the speaker been shown the door? Well, this is this week. What it tells you is there's a dysfunctional government that has the ability not only to tax the citizens, but to rack up debt far beyond the tax base that only burdens the tax base. Because in a perfect world, theoretical world, someday the taxpayers are going to have to pay off the $33 trillion. But they simply can't because there isn't $33 trillion. I mean, the whole American economy is, you know, getting pretty close to that number. And at the end of the day, what we're really struggling with is this lack of responsibility and discipline in Washington that needs to be corrected. And I think the states are going to have to react to that and start to question and challenge how you can have a federal government that just is spending into the vortex, because it burdens all of us as citizens. We're seeing it in inflation, and of course, it's a national security risk. I mean, how can you be the strongest, richest, wealthiest country in the world when you're broke? You can't. And I think America may be living to some extent on its past reputation of you know, post-World War II glory, but at some point, it becomes a real problem. And like I said yesterday, you're seeing other commentators in the Main Street financial press starting to ask these questions. You know, how big is the American economy? And if you're looking at 50% of the people who live here have none of the assets, they're not all small business people contributing and generating growth and revenue and jobs. These are people who don't have anything, really don't have an oar in the water. And it becomes a real question when you have a concentration of wealth. And keep in mind, at that level, in my three silos, you got the poor, and the middle class, and the rich. The rich are very international. It's very easy to move money around the globe if you're wealthy. You hire the accountants and the attorneys, and they make sure that your money is scattered hither and yon so that no matter where you are, your money is elsewhere and you're fully protected. You don't have that in the middle class. It's very unusual in the American middle class that somebody would have creative tax and estate planning and, you know, that figure out how to get money buried offshore anywhere. And if you do, boy, the Treasury Department's looking right at you because they know what you're up to. As a matter of fact, if you want to just take your money and leave the United States, you say, I quit. Here's my passport. I'm going to go become a German. They still tax you for 10 years after you leave, okay? That's here. But if you're in the billionaire class, you can buy yourself an airport in a small country and get yourself a condo. It's a different world. So the point I'm trying to make is that in the American experience, we're seeing a shift of wealth, higher and higher concentrations. The wealthier are becoming so wealthy that this really eclipses the American Gilded Age, which happened in the 1890s, the gay 90s, they used to call it. When, if you've ever been to Newport, Rhode Island, you go to the Breakers and one mansion after another on the shore. And this and Vanderbilt's place North Carolina, Asheville. I mean, these are palaces built in the golden age of American industrial strength. And that ended up by the 1920s. It was a 30-year window to basically have caused the Great Depression, the collapse of Wall Street, as the middle wanted to get into the game, be rich too. The wheels blew off. And I think we're very close to that, where you've got a social situation, you got half of America is decidedly out of the game, and the other half, you know, I mean, it's a problem. I don't want to sound like a communist or a socialist here, but I think it's something that needs to be addressed from a policy perspective. And the only way you can do that is to eliminate the $33 trillion in debt and de-link the average American from the insanity of basically spending the country broke and enslaving the people. Because how do we ever get out of that? In our lifetime, our grandkids' lifetime, you're never going to pay this off and get it back into balance. So it becomes a real political problem, which has an impact, of course, on our personal financial situation and also the financial situation of the country. So anyway, I think I'll stop my lecture for today. And thank you so much for tuning in to WVW-TV and the Eastman Financial Report. We really appreciate your viewership, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Take care. Bye.